The Meaning of Citizenship, Today on the World. I'm Marco Werman. A passport can be a powerful symbol of citizenship, but some countries allow you to buy one, which raises some troubling questions.
Because if you can buy a passport, what does it even mean anymore? Is it really this special thing that you and only you, you know, were chosen to have? Is it really something that also comes with rights and responsibilities?
Also today, an Australian political strategist travels across the U.S., taking the pulse of the national mood ahead of our midterm elections.
It's the same story everywhere we go. Unhappiness that really seems to be underpinning a lot of what we see. And it's a disquiet, I think, which is permeating American society.
Those stories and more here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you here. The word citizen comes from the Latin civis, meaning citizen of ancient Rome. Today's citizen is way more than a city resident. What does it mean, though, and who gets to define it? Big questions triggered this week by President Trump just ahead of the midterm elections. He said he wanted to ban birthright citizenship, the idea that being born in the U.S. means automatic citizenship. We talked about that and the 14th Amendment yesterday. Today we want to spend some time exploring different ideas about citizenship. Let's start with a simple document that is a powerful symbol of citizenship, a passport. Outside your home country, your passport can dictate easy travel or blocked access, because not all passports are created equal. The World's Shirin Jafari starts us off.
It takes a lot of courage to leave your day job to travel the world. It takes even more courage if you're not rich and you hold an Iranian passport. 10 years ago, that's exactly what Mehdi Parsa did. He quit his job as a physics teacher in Tehran, cashed out his savings, and became a full-time traveler, making a bit of money along the way. Parsa has petted huskies in Siberia. He's played the xylophone with locals in Zimbabwe. And he's sung a traditional Swahili song at Mount Kilimanjaro. Full disclosure, I was with him on that trip. He's a friend. Today, Parsa makes a living by organizing and leading budget-friendly tours for small groups of Iranians. When choosing a destination, he tells me, the first question on his mind is, how easy is it going to be to get a visa?
متاسفانه برای من پاسپورت مفهوم یه سد خیلی بزرگ رو داره، یه کوه خیلی بزرگ.
Unfortunately, my passport is a huge barrier, a gigantic mountain, he tells me. He's speaking from his home in Tehran.
قاعدتاً تداعی کننده سفر باید باشه، ولی برای من یادآور.
For a lot of people, the word passport evokes movement, travel. But for me, he says, it's the opposite. It's a reminder of hardship and pain. This got me thinking, how does an Iranian passport compare to others?
I've passed Venezuela, I've passed St. Vincent.
I called up Atusa Araxia Ibrahimian. She's the author of The Cosmopolites, The Coming of the Global Citizen. It's a book about citizenship and passports around the world.
Uzbekistan, Mali, Liberia. I think Iran's all the way down there.
137th, to be exact, out of 168 countries on the list. What Araxia Ibrahimian is looking at is called the Quality of Nationality Index. It's a ranking of countries put together by a private firm. They take into account things like freedom of travel, peace, and stability. France and Germany are at the top of this list. The U.S. ranks 27th.
You don't choose your parents, you don't choose where you're born, you don't always choose where you live, and it's so arbitrary, you know?
Arbitrary. Difficult enough to be the holder of an Iranian passport, even tougher if you're from Syria, South Sudan, Yemen, according to this list. So what do you do if you come from one of these countries, but you have the means to travel? Araxia Ibrahimian says over the past 10 years or so, a whole industry has emerged around the sale of citizenship.
Complete with accountants, lawyers, bankers, all of this whole cottage industry around country selling passports. And one of the ways that they market a citizenship is by quantifying all of the advantages that somebody would obtain by getting the citizenship.
Meaning those passport and nationality rankings we were looking at, they're not just for fun or salt in the wound in my Iranian friend's case. There's big business behind them.
So my name is Dominic Volek. I am the managing partner of Henley & Partners in Singapore.
Henley & Partners is one of the leading companies that rank passports and citizenship. Every September, a group of researchers at the company receives a set of data from the International Air Transport Association. It's a trade organization made up of major airlines.
This is exclusive data that they provide to us on a fixed date every year.
These researchers take that information and add in others they get from various governments. Then they come up with a ranking for passports. Who is this for?
The profile of our clients are typically entrepreneurs. Of course, you get the odd client that nowadays, you know, has maybe, you know, made a fortune on cryptocurrencies or has just inherited a lot of money. Of course, we get lots of very interesting characters.
Sadly, Volek won't tell me more about these clients. But he says, look, imagine you're a rich business owner in Bangladesh and you want to travel for work, but you're limited because of the passport you hold. Well, you can invest in a country with a higher ranking passport and get a new one.
So at least half of the reason why people are doing citizenship by investment is to acquire a second citizenship and to get greater mobility. And there the Caribbean and places like Moldova have visa-free access to the Schengen.
That's most of Europe.
Singapore, Hong Kong, which makes both business and leisure much easier for these individuals.
How much you would have to invest varies. It starts from just $100,000 in Dominica, for example, to 25 times that amount in Cyprus. And Volek says these investments, they can be a lifeline for struggling economies. He points to St. Kitts and Nevis in the Caribbean, where the sugar industry had recently collapsed.
The country was either going to, you know, sink into poverty, or they created this program which then brought a lot of investments into the country and creates jobs.
Also, after Hurricanes Maria and Irma hit the Caribbean last year, some countries began selling their citizenship at a discounted price to raise emergency funds. But that's not the whole story.
It's not all tourism and you know, visiting the wonders of the world. Like, there's some pretty dark stuff that's going on beneath.
Like fraud and tax evasion. Just recently, the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, listed 21 countries whose citizenship programs appear to encourage tax evasion.
And, you know, they're not very pleased with the state of affairs.
But the OECD is a think tank that doesn't have the power to police any abuses. It just offers recommendations. Beyond all this, Araxia Ebrahimian thinks something more fundamental is going on. By putting up citizenship for sale, we are changing how we define nationality without really talking about it.
It actually really kind of cheapens the value of citizenship from a sort of statecraft perspective, from a sort of civic perspective, right? Because if you can buy a passport, what does it even mean anymore? Is it really this special thing that you and only you, you know, we're chosen to have? Is it really something that also comes with rights and responsibilities?
Meanwhile, companies that broker citizenship investments are bullish about the future. According to Henley & Partners, there's a rise in the number of Americans applying for a second or third citizenship. One client, they say, renounced his American citizenship altogether to get one from Singapore, which happens to rank number one on Henley & Partners' list of most powerful passports. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
There's a whole lot wrapped up in citizenship. It's about privilege, ease of travel, access to certain rights and benefits. It's also about identity, and of course, it's also about politics. Germany has also been grappling with citizenship. The Turkish immigrant population in Germany is large and goes back decades. For a long time, though, Turks were not seen as German citizens and denied access to citizenship. That has changed, but it's been a complicated process, legally and politically. Werner Patzelt is a political scientist at the Technical University of Dresden. Give us a context here, Professor. When was the first big Turkish migration to Germany?
The first big migration of Turkish to Germany took place back in the late 50s and throughout the 60s, when German economy was developing quite rapidly and there was not enough labor force in Germany. And therefore, the German government tried to attract as many Italian, Greeks and Spanish and so on to work in Germany for a period of 2, 3, 4 years and then going back home. And as soon as the economies of Italy, Greece, and so on had recovered, there was no longer supply from these countries. And therefore, the German government started to attract people from Turkey and did so until the 70s.
Did the German government think that all those people would go home, and did that happen?
It was a basic idea that these people came only for work in Germany, and that after some years, when they had made enough money, they would go back home. But they did not, because they felt that they would have a better life, or at least better economic perspectives in Germany. And then they got the right to bring their families to Germany. And it happened that they could live in Germany just like living in Turkey. And therefore, no integration of this Turkish minority took place, but parallel societies emerged, which we did not want to take into consideration as a societal problem.
What happened next, and what was the public mood or appetite for absorbing all of these foreigners?
As long as there was only this Turkish minority in Germany, there was no significant problem. But later on, our liberal regulations on asylum seekers attracted hundreds of thousands of asylum seekers in the late 80s and in the early 90s. So the German society had to accept something like 500,000, 600,000 immigrants in the early 90s. And in this time, that xenophobia, this fear for having too many people from the outside world coming to Germany, only benefiting from the social security system in Germany, this kind of xenophobia has grown up.
Let me just jump in here and fast forward a bit. In the late 90s, all of this changed in Germany. A center-left party came to power and completely overhauled the immigration system. It used to be that you could only be a citizen of Germany if you had German blood. But in 1999, Germany switched to birthright citizenship. It extended citizenship to anyone born on German soil as long as one parent had legal status in Germany. Now back to my conversation with Werner Patzelt. I asked him what the consequences are for Germany today of that policy shift in 1999.
Well, these regulations have created some problems, which would not have been as severe as they are if we had not had this huge influx of immigrants back in 2015. Something like a new seriousness in discussing these issues seems to reappear in German politics. And therefore, I feel that in the coming months and years, we will have some not only ideological but practically minded debate on how we should handle our citizenship issues.
Yes, so what I'm hearing is that there have been a lot of ups and downs with citizenship in Germany that tracks migration to the country. Today, 2018, what have Germans decided that citizenship is?
There is no consensus. There is no agreement. There is sharp confrontation between both political camps. Indeed, Germany never has had a clear immigration and integration policy. And still today, Germany has no clear policy on that.
Does this remind you of the U.S.?
In one way, it reminds me of the U.S., but the difference is that ever since its beginnings, the U.S. have been an immigration society. This has never been the case in Germany, and this, I feel, is the basic difference in the cultural background of all of these problems.
Of course, that could all change under Donald Trump.
This could change under Donald Trump, and this is why we as Europeans look with so much interest and so much curiosity on what's going on in the United States. And we really hope that the United States will not go down that way that Imperial Germany went down, being overconfident over its capacities and being over-enthusiastic about its role in the world.
Werner Patzelt, political scientist at the Technical University of Dresden. Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure talking to you.
You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks to the Trump effect, there's a lot of interest around the globe in our midterm elections next week, enough to send an Australian political strategist halfway across the planet. Bruce Hawker is his name. For the past month, he's been traveling around the U.S. speaking with voters and filming a documentary about it. What struck him so far? Here's what he said. And mind you, this was before the Pittsburgh synagogue attack.
Division,
we were struck by the amount of division in America. I mean, I've been travelling here since 1996 to observe presidential campaigns, and I've never seen anything quite like that. Everybody is in their respective camp, and it's almost impossible to find anybody who is sitting on the fence here. They're all in one camp or the other and have very, very strongly held views about Donald Trump. He is the story. And I don't get a sense that Americans are very happy politically right now, even those who...
On either side.
I think there's this sense of disconnect, and it upsets people. It's the same story everywhere we go. Unhappiness that really seems to be underpinning a lot of what we see. And it's a disquiet, I think, which is permeating American society right now, even for people who are very strong Trump supporters and would probably see themselves as being in the ascendancy. So that's the hard road that I think Americans are taking right now.
So the big question you're trying to answer, talking to American voters, is what matters to you? How varied have those answers been?
Extremely. I mean, people who are Trump supporters, they see Trump as being somebody who's just shaking up the country in a way that has never been done before. And they believe that he's achieving things. And they'll cite North Korea as an example of that, the tariff wars with China. On the other side of the coin, though, it's division. It's the shouting out. It's the singling out of minority groups and individuals that people find very offensive and drives a lot of their intentions in this midterm election.
Yeah, I mean, the trade war and tariffs, that's not necessarily a good thing for people in the middle of the country, farmers, for example. Are you finding that?
That is a fascinating thing. You know, we were just in Breckenridge, Minnesota, just a few days ago, and we conducted a little focus group there, primarily amongst farmers. And what they told us was that even though China is not buying their crops, they're down by about 25% in returns, they were prepared to give Donald Trump a chance to sort out this war with the Chinese. But then we'd speak to other farmers and say, well, that's well and good, but our silos are now full. And if we don't sort this problem out really soon, we're going to have another harvest next year. And we're not going to have anything to do with it. So it's interesting that sometimes their emotional attachment to a person or to a cause can outweigh the hip pocket nerve, as we call it in Australia, which usually motivates what people's voting intentions are going to be.
Have you ever seen a dynamic like that back in Australia?
It's very rare, except in Australia, we do have something of a Trump phenomenon. It usually comes with people who were once calling the shots in a society where they feel that they've been left out, left behind, and they will sometimes support candidates who don't represent their interests. And that happened a few years ago when we had a woman called Pauline Hanson. She's still around, and she ran a party called One Nation, very populist, and she was upsetting Asians and Asian tourists to Australia, but people in tourist-dependent electorates were voting for her. And so, yeah, sometimes people vote against their interests. I read an article once and it said, why do turkeys vote for Thanksgiving? Sometimes that just happens. The question, though, I think that we're going to have to be asking in 2 years' time if we come back is, well, has Trump delivered on the big things that he said he was going to? Because right now, what we're seeing is that people who might be sitting in the middle are more inclined to say, we'll give him a chance. We're going to see how he goes. And that may mean that the so-called blue wave that's coming might just be more of a trickle.
How much does an issue like immigration or what we were talking about earlier, tariffs and trade, how much did the opinions you heard from Americans vary depending on the region?
Well, it depended to a large extent, actually. In South Carolina, you cannot get away from race as an issue. And people of color there were very, very distressed. They felt that they were being singled out by Donald Trump. And in fact, we spoke to a 77-year-old man, African-American, who grew up in the days of segregation in South Carolina, had refused admission into lunch counters and restaurants and saw it in its rawest. And he said he had never seen anything like Donald Trump in his lifetime. He had never seen such overt racism, in his view, coming from a president or somebody in such high office. He said it was much more subtle in the past, and he felt it, but he'd never felt this raw exposure.
That's extraordinary. Bruce, you've been in the U.S. before, and as you know, the midterm elections historically have low voter turnout. What's it like in Australia? Is there a greater sense there that you have to take care of the civic responsibility of casting a vote?
Well, in Australia, we have compulsory voting, so the legislature has taken that responsibility out of our hands and told us we'll be fined if we don't. But Australians take it for granted, really, that they have to vote on election day, and we have 95% turnout. And that, of course, changes the nature of politics in Australia. It means that the politicians are much more focused on the centre rather than having to energise their base all the time. If you have compulsory voting, you're a politician in Australia, you know that your traditional voters are going to come out and support you. It's the people in the middle that you have to convince. And that means that Australian politics, even though it sounds very divisive at times, still is much more inclusive in the basic tenets that underpin the major political parties. For example, we have a national health scheme which would never be touched by either of the major parties, I don't think, in my lifetime. It just is not an issue. They know that if they were to depart from that, that would be the end of their prospects of winning an election.
Do you get the sense that Americans are more motivated to go to the polls this year?
Massively more motivated. Everywhere we go, we're hearing reports from journalists and others that turnout is greater with early voting and also with registration, that the Kavanaugh issue has motivated and energised Democratic voters, particularly women. So on both sides, we're seeing this remarkable energising. I'd be very surprised if we don't see record midterm voting turnout. And we're also getting reports that in states like Georgia, where there's been allegations of voter suppression, that has had a reverse effect, and that there has been a very high turnout before the election day by people who presumably are offended by what's happened there. And one of the things we've been doing is talking to young people and asking them, well, what do you think about Donald Trump and the priorities that he has? And they basically say they're totally out of step with what we are worried about. And the number one issue that we get back is climate change, because this is the generation that's going to have to deal with these problems. The other is intergenerational debt. But they really do worry about climate and climate change. And you can understand why. You know, I won't be around to see the worst effects of climate change, but they will. And I think that will become a bigger and bigger issue as this generation starts to assert more and more power.
Bruce Hawker is an Australian political strategist. He's been filming a documentary called A Hard Road, Travels in Trump's America. We'll speak with him again after the midterms. By the way, if you're a new U.S. citizen and are voting for the first time here in America, we want to hear from you. What does voting mean to you? And how does it compare with voting in another country? Email us at this address, myworld@theworld.org. Again, that's myworld@theworld.org. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, NATO war games in Scandinavia are the biggest since the Cold War. Plus, retired General Stanley McChrystal thinks sending U.S. troops to the border with Mexico is misguided.
We shouldn't even send the idea that this is going to defend the walls of the Alamo.
Those stories just ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. U.S. troops are taking part in two big military operations right now. One is Faithful Patriot, involving 5,000-plus American troops being deployed to the U.S.-Mexico border. I spoke with retired General Stanley McChrystal today, who told me what he thinks that operation says about America's leadership these days. That's just ahead. First to a far larger operation now underway in Northern Europe. It's called Trident Juncture. Trident Juncture involves some 50,000 personnel from 29 countries. It's the biggest NATO exercise since the end of the Cold War. The main part of the exercise is in Norway. Reporter Charles Maines is there in Trondheim. So you've been out with the troops this week, Charles. What have you seen and who have you talked to?
Well, yesterday they had a big media day event. This was kind of a big synchronized amphibious assault. They brought in air power, all simulating this attack against a NATO ally, in this case Norway, which triggered Article 5, according to NATO. This is the collective defense. So this was designed to show that Article 5 still matters today in this age, with Norway here as the sacrificial lamb.
What was the mood among the troops you spoke with?
Well, everyone seemed to be pretty much enjoying themselves. A lot of these guys, certainly from the United States, they were coming from mostly the southeast of the United States, so North Carolina, Florida, And for them, I think, of course, one of the big kind of stunning aspects of this whole thing is being up in Norway, of course, a northern climate. In fact, I had a chance to talk to Lieutenant Luis Pinochet. He's of the United States Marine Corps. He was one of the rare ones, in fact, who'd actually had some experience with this beforehand, having taken a cold weather course with Norwegians. But he had this bit of advice for his fellow Marines.
I spent a month here at the beginning of the year learning from them, and I think that someone who isn't as prepared for the cold can learn a few things from the Norwegians or typical countries that work in this type of environment.
Charles, for you, how cold is it?
Well, actually, today was a little bit warm, but very wet. It's hovering around zero, depending on the wind chill and things like that. It can get a little bit more brutal. But, you know, these guys you talked to today, and we were out with Marines walking around a bit, they all say that the weather's just kind of shifted back and forth, unpredictable weather in Norway, as usual for this time of year.
So let's talk about what this whole NATO exercise Trident Juncture actually means. Who's taking part in this?
Well, this is members of all 29 NATO allies, all 29 NATO countries, plus partners in Finland and Sweden. As you noted in your intro, it's a massive exercise with 50,000 personnel. There are about 65 ships taking part, 150 aircraft, 10,000 vehicles. So it's this massive exercise. But in terms of who they're actually directed at, well, NATO seems to stress that this is all a fictitious enemy. And of course, so does the U.S. I had a chance to talk with Admiral James Fogo. He's commander of the Allied Joint Force Command in Naples, Italy, and was leading the U.S. team up here in Norway.
We don't pick any particular individual. The names used in the exercise are fictitious. We're not interested in taking anybody else's territory. The alliance is about defensive operations and protecting the sovereignty and the borders of those member nations, the 29.
Charles, I mean, given Donald Trump's criticism of NATO, is perhaps this exercise a reminder to the president of the United States about Article 5 and his responsibilities?
Yeah, I think that's one of the stories here behind the scenes, is a concern over just the U.S.'s commitment. And this, in some ways, was a reassurance. You heard again and again from people, from NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, to the U.S. ambassador to NATO, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, saying that, you know, the NATO alliance is as strong as ever. It was interesting to hear also Mr. Stoltenberg talk about how, again, these exercises were not targeted against anyone. But the same breath, he'd say, you know, we're facing the most challenging security environment in a generation. And this brings us back to, you know, the reality of today. And no one doubts that this is a message to Russia, from states that border Russia, such as Norway and the Baltic states, you know, who are really increasingly worried about what they see as aggressive behavior, particularly after the annexation of Crimea and Russia's proxy war in East Ukraine. And this is really a sense to say that, you know, Article 5 matters, and I think that it matters to the Trump administration.
Reporter Charles Maines in Trondheim, Norway. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Retired General Stanley McChrystal knows a thing or two about war. He spent most of his career in special operations, and he was also commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Now McChrystal is reconsidering the notion of leadership in a new book. It profiles 13 leaders from wildly different backgrounds.
What they had in common was this white-hot burning conviction in their cause.
One of the leaders McChrystal profiles is someone he calls a zealot, Musab al-Zarqawi, the former head of al-Qaeda in Iraq.
At one point, he had a razor blade smuggled into the prison, and he cuts off a tattoo that he'd put on in his youth because it is a violation of Islam. And the other inmates are able to see that. And here's a guy who proves that he's willing to walk the walk all the time. And then later, as he leads al-Qaeda in Iraq, it's the same thing. It's not the brilliance of his ideas or strategy. It's his absolute conviction that makes us attracted, us as followers, people attracted to someone who's so zealous.
So charisma and passion, key for leadership. Are zealots, though, good leaders? And where does charisma and passion start to turn into zealotry?
Well, it's interesting. Charisma and passion are usually good, and we as followers are attracted to them. But just like zealots, they can take us to the wrong place. And what we found with our zealots, it's like a flame that burns so hot that it burns the oxygen in a room. In the case of Zarqawi, we killed him, but he was necessarily going to die because he was burning too hot from the environment in which he was in. Even the Iraqis who followed him didn't share the same level of commitment he did. So by the time we killed him, I'd like to believe I was at the point where I understood that he believed in his cause just as much as I believed in mine, maybe more. And who's to say he's not right? I mean, in reality, had I been raised in his background and exposed to the things, who's to say that I wouldn't have been exactly on the side of the line? And I think that's what's important for all of us to remember. Just because you disagree with something doesn't make you right.
So can we talk about your own role as leader? Because you led these highly classified missions in Iraq that led to Musab al-Zarqawi in 2006 being killed. You were also the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, a war that's now entering its 18th year. As soldiers are signing up, as you know, who were not even born when that war began. Is that a colossal failure of leadership?
Well, I don't know if it's a failure of leadership, because there's been some good leaders. There's certainly a failure of policy, or its lack of success of policy, if we're talking Afghanistan in particular.
Well, you had troubles with the Obama administration, your bosses, and your tenure in Afghanistan was terminated. Where did the leadership there fail?
Well, I mean, part of it on my end. The reality is, although President Obama had a different policy view than I did, not hugely different. I was, you know, very supportive of what he asked me to do. But at a point, a news story came out, or a media story in Rolling Stone magazine, that I didn't think was fair. But at the same time, I'm a commander in Afghanistan, and it's my job not to let hot stories land on the desk of the commander-in-chief. So that was my failure, whether I disagreed with it or not.
General McChrystal, let's talk about current leadership. You're retired now, and we're seeing U.S. troops play new roles. This week we learned that the Pentagon is sending more than 5,000 troops to the Mexican border. 5,000 is more than double the number of troops in Syria. What does that decision tell us about our current leadership?
The decision to send U.S. forces to somewhere like the border is a symbol. And in the minds of some Americans, it probably says, aha, we have an invasion coming, or we have an emergency. We have to protect the homeland. And while that's not the case, it creates that mental image. And sending regular military forces down there sends the idea that we're going to be decisive. If we're really defending, what we ought to do is put drones out to get targeting and do airstrikes on the migrant convoy and just stop it before it gets close. But of course, that's absurd. And that's immoral. And that's not something that we're even thinking about doing. But we shouldn't even send the idea that this is going to defend the walls of the Alamo. However, in some ways, it is a crisis. It's a crisis because up close, we're going to have the arrival of a number of people who want entry into the United States. In many cases, they have a pretty valid reason for wanting to leave Honduras or Guatemala. A lack of opportunity plus threats to them. And so now we're going to be up close and personal with a moral issue. So I think it's when we talk about putting military around, we almost confuse the issue, because the root issue here is one of our immigration policy and then America's values. And we've got to look in the mirror, decide what our values are, adjust our policy, it reflects those. And it's got to be a compromise, because not all Americans are going to agree.
So how do you feel our country is being led? Lay it out for me. What is your take on the tone being set by the Oval Office?
I don't think our country's being led well at all right now, but I would expand it beyond the Oval Office. I would say on the left and the right, there's a shrillness to the rhetoric now. And this gets back to what we talked about earlier in values. We need, instead of looking at the TV and yelling at whatever side we don't like, we need to look in the mirror. And we need to say, all right, what are our values? What do we want from our leaders? Because I don't expect the president to have the answers. I expect the president to create an ecosystem in which the answers can be reached. But I expect the president to reflect our values. I expect to reflect the values for me. I expect the president to inspire me to be better than I might otherwise be. When I am weary and impatient, I expect the president to be the kind of symbol that says, wow, I need to be a little more patient. I need to be a little more energetic, whatever it is I need to be, a little more courageous, a little more compassionate. I expect the president to reflect all the things that we hope we can be.
And does Donald Trump reflect your values? Does he reflect American values?
Well, I think each of us has to ask ourselves that question.
I'm asking you, does he reflect your values, General?
I think I just answered that question. I don't believe that President Trump reflects the kind of inspirational leadership that I respond to, but I'm one person. And the real question is how each of us do. And we need to be very honest with ourselves first and then with each other.
General Stanley McChrystal, his new book is Leaders, Myth and Reality. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Boo. Okay, like many Halloween stories, our starts in a graveyard. Here's my WGBH colleague, Edgar B. Herwick III.
The Chestnut Hill Cemetery in Exeter, Rhode Island, is like a lot of cemeteries here in New England. It's lined by trees and dotted with weathered gravestones stretching back centuries. As Joyce Bastian, a local here, explains...
People are in here all the time. All ages, all types of people, everything. Nonstop.
They come from far and wide because of what happened here one March night in 1883. Young Edwin Brown was dying, just as his mother Mary had died, just as his sisters Mary Olive and Mercy had died. As author Michael Bell explains, Edwin's father, George Brown, had tried everything to save him. Nearly everything.
Neighbors and other relatives, they were aware that, you know, if Edwin died and it took out all of the Brown family, that it wouldn't stop there, whatever it was.
And so George Brown relented. There was only one way to know for sure if one of his deceased family members was now the undead creature consuming his son to feed its own unholy immortality. They had to dig them all up. First, Mary and Mary Olive.
They were basically decomposed, as you would expect them to be, since they had been dead for several years.
But Mercy, just 19 when she died, had been lying dead in a crypt for just 2 months. It was likely the winter weather that had kept her body from decomposing, and why her heart still contained liquid blood. Nevertheless, to the small group there, these were the telltale signs. Mercy Brown was a vampire.
So they cut out her heart and burned it to ashes on a rock nearby the site. Edwin was supposed to have taken the ashes to consume, drink them in water.
We don't know for sure whether Edwin did consume them, but we do know that he died not long after, as his sisters had, as his mother had, of tuberculosis, known then as consumption. The Mercy Brown incident was the last known case of the New England vampire panic.
Most of the time I'm dealing with the vampires of folklore and history.
Bell, who has a PhD in mythology, has researched and written extensively about the New England vampire panic. Over the course of a century, at least 70 ritual exhumations like the one here in Exeter were performed throughout New England. They were attempts to stop the spread of the devastating and then little understood disease of tuberculosis.
There are times in life when you need to have an answer. You need to have a course of action, not just sit there and watch your family die. And so folklore provided an avenue for this.
This particular brand of folklore was a variant on a practice born in places like Romania, Hungary, and Germany. The idea was that one of the dead victims was not in fact dead, but keeping itself alive in the grave by feeding on the blood and flesh of the living. To stop it, you had to find it and eradicate it.
They would usually cut out that organ that had the fresh blood, whether it was the heart, liver, lungs, whatever.
Bell says these practices were likely introduced to New England by traveling quacks. And this same curious magical folk practice also provided inspiration to European writers who developed their own version of the vampire myth, one we know well today through pop culture and fiction.
The vampires in New England were real. They just happened to be microbes. They were germs with fangs.
Fear of the unknown is a powerful force. By the 1800s, New Englanders knew there had been no witches in Salem in the 1600s. And today, we know there were no vampires here in the 1800s. But Bell says, don't be so quick to judge. We may have access to far more information today, but we're no more intelligent than the people of the past. And 200 years from now, who knows which of our beliefs and practices might seem utterly quaint and ridiculous. For The World, Edgar B. Herwick III, Exeter, Rhode Island.
Blasphemy is a capital offense in Pakistan, but today the Supreme Court there freed a Christian woman who was on death row allegedly for disrespecting Islam. Asia Noreen, also known as Asia Bibi, had spent the last 8 years in solitary confinement. Rabia Mahmood is with Amnesty International in Pakistan. She told me why Asia Bibi was acquitted.
She's acquitted because she was not found guilty of any kind of blasphemy. The allegation against her was that she was disrespectful towards Islam, which is the majority religion in Pakistan. But actually, the person who filed a complaint against Asia, he was not even present there. And it happens in a lot of cases of blasphemy that a lot of cases are filed on, based on rumors and hearsay because people have ulterior motives. They want to settle some scores, some economic gains, or it's just sometimes it's part of a larger campaign against religious minority in an area that people want to intimidate and harass those communities.
Meanwhile, she's been in solitary confinement for 8 years. How has Asia Bibi reacted now that she's been set free?
So we've been seeing reports that she could not believe that she's been acquitted. And other activists who've been working on this case closely have said that she's been unwell. It's not hard to imagine, considering that she was the way she was harassed and then arrested, and how traumatic this must have been, and being in solitary confinement for years.
What has been the reaction to this acquittal of Asia Bibi in Pakistan?
So there was a celebration, but there are hardliners who've been agitating today. They called for protests and roadblocks and shutting down of certain areas and of striking. And parts of the country were completely at standstill. But the prime minister's address to the nation, people are also looking at that with a lot of hope, because he spoke against those agitators and he spoke against the mob and stood by the Supreme Court's judgment also. So that's a good, strong message that we, the Pakistan really needed.
I'd like us to hear comments from Asia Bibi's lawyer. He spoke with my colleagues at the BBC before this decision, this acquittal, was announced, and he was asked about what would happen if his client was acquitted. Here's what he had to say.
I can't live in this country after that. It's already difficult for the last 6 years, and after this, there'll be zero chance to live.
So Asia Bibi's lawyer there implying that an acquittal would mean he and his client will never be left in peace if they stay in Pakistan. She was acquitted, of course. So what happens now to Asia Bibi and her lawyer?
It's completely impossible for them to live here. It's entirely impossible. It's not just Asia Bibi. In the past, there have been other people who were acquitted of blasphemy and they had to leave.
It sounds like it's far from a total victory for Asia Bibi. I mean, what does this decision mean for how blasphemy laws are going to be enforced in Pakistan in the future?
It really is far from victory for her, but she's released and her family, at least they will be safe. Mm. But as far as what this verdict does, it sets a precedent, and it also sends a very strong message for religious tolerance, and it sends a message to people who accuse others falsely. That's why we're looking at this verdict with hope. But there are people who are still on death row because of blasphemy laws. There are people who are also in prison because of religiously motivated discriminatory laws. So it's one victory, but it's definitely, you know, it's a long battle, as I said.
Rabia Mahmood with Amnesty International speaking with us from Pakistan. Rabia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Finally today, it's been more than a year since Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. Thousands of people lost their homes and relocated to the U.S. mainland. But compared to victims of natural disasters on the mainland, evacuees from Puerto Rico got less federal support. That's left some cities on the mainland scrambling. WHYY's Catalina Jaramilla looks at how Philadelphia has responded.
About 130,000 people fled Puerto Rico after Maria. The majority ended up in Florida. But many others came to cities in New York, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Texas, and Connecticut. These evacuees have received much less federal support than those displaced by natural disasters on the mainland.
What I think we've seen now is a sense that many Maria evacuees have been invisible.
Laura Olson is with the Center for Disaster and Community Resilience at Jacksonville State University. She says after Hurricane Katrina, evacuees were officially relocated by the federal government. But after Hurricane Maria, most Puerto Ricans have to pay their own flights to places where no one was waiting for them. Suddenly, cities across the country had hundreds of families in need of housing and other basic services.
So that sets up a difference. If you're not reimbursed, there's a shortage of resources.
And that has meant in cities throughout the country, Maria evacuees have been scrambling to find places to stay. But that's not the case in Philadelphia. At least 900 families ended up there after Maria, and none of them have had to live in shelters. In fact, all of those staying in hotels now have a permanent place to stay, including Lidia Adorno and her family. I meet them at their apartment in North Philadelphia.
Okay, hello, bienvenida.
Hola.
Adorno and her family fled Puerto Rico in November. She and her two kids were staying with family, while her husband was staying at a church. But now they have moved to a public housing unit with three rooms and one bathroom.
This is the stairs, this is the second floor.
Her daughter, Diane, shows off her new room.
This is my room.
She says what she missed the most about having a house are things we usually take for granted, like hanging her clothes in a closet, or just spending time with her brother, her mom, or her dad, with no one else around.
I love my cousins, but you know, there's privacy, like family privacy.
When Puerto Rican families came to Philadelphia, a committee was formed by local government, global disaster relief organizations, and Latino advocacy groups. They decided to create a new kind of public-private partnership that could pool resources and provide stable housing and other services for Maria evacuees.
This is the city of brotherly love. Like, that's what we're supposed to do.
That's Julia Menso. She's with Liberty Lutheran in Philadelphia and leads the Long-Term Recovery Committee. The committee created a one-stop shop for evacuees who need services. By the end of June, 44 families staying in hotels were relocated into housing.
We've reached out to families to find out what, you know, help them to identify their own plan moving forward and finding apartments.
As dinner gets ready in Lydia's house, her husband Pedro brings a guitar and starts playing a song. They tell me it's a song they've been singing as a family in their church in Puerto Rico since before Hurricane Maria. Their son, Brian, sings.
Calma, nunca pierdas la esperanza. Dios permite.
The lyrics say, stay calm, don't lose hope. God gives you blessing, even when there are storms. For the world, I'm Catalina Jaramillo.
Calma. Que la vida no se acaba.
That's it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back here tomorrow.
Volverás a sonreír. Calma, nunca pierdas la esperanza.
PRI, Public Radio International.